nation. But Bush and the Republicans could take the rejection. They counted the votes in a web of deception. The GOP stole the election. It's a good thing that Saddam was captured, hiding in a hole just like a rat would. Now they're saying that the war went on because their intelligence was wrong. Was the reason for war based on lies and corruption? Where are the weapons of mass destruction? Out the Republicans. Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. And that song that I was trying to sing along with a little bit is Kick Out the Republicans by Donnie Daly. If you listen on the internet, you are able to hear the entire song. It is, of course, a theme song that says that today is Election Tuesday. Every Tuesday here on the Inside Scoop, for the last 6 months, we have played that song as I bring on air people with whom I disagree. And you may be feeling nostalgic about the song now because it is the penultimate time you will hear it. Penultimate is a big fancy word that means next to last. Today is the next to last time you will hear the song Kick Out the Republicans, because next week, 7 days from today, it's amazing, it's already here. It won't be Election Tuesday on the Inside Scoop. It'll be Election Tuesday nationwide. And everyone listening to my voice, because I trust my listeners, everyone listening to my voice will have either voted already in early voting or will be going out to vote that day. Next Tuesday, the last time you will hear Donnie Daly's song, Kick Out the Republicans, at least until the next election, next Tuesday will be the first time Americans will have the opportunity to freely and fairly choose the President of the United States since 1996, since the election of Bill Clinton over Bob Dole. We all know what happened 4 years ago. The United States Supreme Court said that the American people could not be entrusted to make that choice. It was too confusing. Catherine Harris made too many mistakes. They were going to choose the president themselves. And they threw away 170,000 votes of people in Florida who, if their votes had been counted in the way they intended, would have elected Albert Gore president of the United States based on the votes in Florida. Well, hopefully in 1 week, we will get the chance that we haven't had in 8 years to choose our own president, to let we, the people, decide. And, of course, it's a very big day, and that means that today is the last of my many Election Tuesdays. Every Tuesday for the last 6 months, you've heard it, I've invited on the air people with whom I disagree. Normally, they're Republicans. That's true. Normally, it's Republicans with whom I disagree. But not always. Some of you may remember a few months ago, I had Ralph Nader's spokesman on the air. Kevin Zeese and I battled it out, duked it out here on this show. But yes, they are normally Republicans, and we've had members of Congress, we've had supporters and members of the Bush administration, spokespeople for the Bush administration. We've had a slew of college Republicans here on the show, and yes, a number of nationally syndicated talk show hosts. Well, my guest today is in the latter category. His name is Alan Nathan, and he is a nationally syndicated talk show host. His radio show, Battle Line, is heard in radio stations across the country, and he, in fact, invited me onto his show just a few days ago, and so I'm returning him the same courtesy. Now, Alan Nathan is not a Republican. He says that he doesn't want to be a Republican because he wants Republicans out of our bedroom. But he's not a Democrat either. No, Alan Nathan calls himself a militant moderate. He says he's not a Democrat because he wants the Democrats out of our wallets, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me, given that if you're a fiscal conservative, you're going to support John Kerry. Because for the last 25 years, of course, it's the Democrats that have better managed American money than the Republicans. So I don't know why Alan Nathan, the militant moderate, self-proclaimed, is actually endorsing George W. Bush. It's a shocking thing for me. I understand how a religious conservative supports George W. Bush, but a militant moderate? What could possibly be on his mind? Well, you will have a chance to ask him that question and to challenge him. You know what to do. You just call in, pick up the phone, dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-577-2667. Hey, call in, challenge Alan, challenge me, or you can do what so many of you have already done and comment on the blog. Just go to www.radioinsidescoop.com, post your challenge to me or to Alan, your comment, your question. We'll be reading a lot of those on the air. But let me first introduce my guest, Alan Nathan. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, Mark, how's it going today?
Well, I want you to try to explain to my listeners why you, the self-proclaimed militant moderate, actually are falling for George W. Bush. What is it?
Well, the reality is I find that with Kerry, he unfortunately, and I say this as a Clinton supporter who would support him again if he were running as the centrist I remember him to be, but with Kerry, I'm afraid that too often he asserts in his denial what he denies having asserted when it comes on when it comes to things such as national defense, the war on terror, and the conflict going on in Iraq. It's that kaleidoscopic grasp of conviction that leads me to believe such as folks like former Mayor Koch of New York, who's a die-in-the-wool Democrat, to believe that Kerry's not up to the job.
Well, here's what I don't understand. If it's what you're worried about is Kerry's statements and changing statements on national security, what about George W. Bush? He's against nation building, then he's for nation building. He's against 9/11 Commission, he's for the 9/11 Commission. He can't seem to find weapons of mass destruction. He comes up with 23 different ways to justify invading Iraq. And now, just yesterday, it's reported that George W. Bush, due to his incompetence, has misplaced some 760,000 pounds of the most deadly conventional explosive known to man in Iraq. And you think Bush is better on national security?
Well, if memory serves, I think it was 380 tons of explosives that are missing from Al-Qaqa site in Iraq. But the Bush team response is that they, of course, had destroyed over 40,000 tons of arms and explosives. But still, you know, you could say, hey, that's good for context, but still 380 is still 380. However, now we understand that when they arrived shortly after the attack in Iraq, they were not to be found. That's the administration's new position. So you can take it for what it's worth, but they're stating that, look, they weren't there upon our arrival. We can hardly be held accountable for that which was not there when we came a-knocking. So, you know, people of goodwill can take away from that what they will.
Well, first of all, 380 tons is 760,000 pounds. You can use one. It's interchangeable, one or the other.
I'm sorry. I thought you said 700 and somewhat. I thought you were saying in tons for both.
Sorry. 380 tons, 760,000 pounds. Either way, it's a lot of explosives. In fact, it would take 40 large trucks to carry out this much material, and it's not like the other ordinary munitions. I mean, as you and I know, Alan, as our listeners know, a number of the Palestinians who've tried to commit suicide bombs in Israel have blown themselves up because of the nature of dealing with ordinary explosives. These are much more dangerous because you can actually drop them. You can hit them with a hammer. It needs a detonator. So these kinds of plastic explosives are actually perfect for terrorists. They can carry them around. They can pack them. They can put them on planes. And it just takes a detonator. 1 pound, actually one report said half a pound of what the 760,000 pounds that were lost was what was used to down Pan Am over Lockerbie.
Agreed, Mark, but my point is still nonetheless, if the Bush administration is to be believed, and again, people of goodwill can say that he's filled with sophistry or he's denying the obvious, but if we're to believe the administration's position, that being that they weren't there upon our arrival in Iraq, then they haven't been you can't lose that which you never had. You can say that we haven't located them yet, and that would not be a new thing, not finding stuff, but you can't lose that which you never possessed, and that's the administration's position right now, and again, people can take from that what they wish.
Well, you say you can't lose what you never had,
yeah.
But we had this.
Well, that's what they're saying they didn't.
No, but there's no dispute that the United Nations inspectors knew where this was, that it was there in January 2003, no one disputes that we knew exactly what location they were at. Let me ask you this, if you were president of the United States, and you're about to declare war on a country, and you know where these bombs are, these explosives, you know exactly where they are, wouldn't you drop a smart bomb and just end it right there and not have to worry about it before you send the troops in?
Well, if these things were locked up with the UN seal, as apparently the allegation suggests was the case, and they're still there, then I don't know that you would. I mean, but it's up to military commanders to make that assessment. My position on Kerry is basically on his inability to render a consistent and cohesive and comprehensive policy agenda that resembles in any way, shape, or form the one that he might have announced the previous week. And I think to have this kind of off-again, on-again grasp of intention is dangerous. You might have seen in today's Washington Post, Kerry was quoted as saying that he'll never give veto power to any institution or foreign government, yet in the first presidential debate, he said that before going to war in Iraq, he would have asked the UN the following, and I quote, "What do you need? What do you need now? How much more will it take to get you to join us?" Again, obviously, he asserts in his denial what he denies having asserted. You can't on one hand say that you won't fork over veto power, and then through your explanation, give a definition of what veto power is.
Okay, I want to address that. I just want to finish up on the point of the explosive just by concluding by saying that the New York Times article that first reported this reports that White House and Pentagon officials acknowledged the explosive vanished before vanished sometime after, important word, sometime after the American-led invasion. That's also the position of the IAEA. It's also the position of the Iraqi government. And this new idea I know was posted on the Matt Drudge website by some high-placed Republican. But apparently our satellite photos, at least according to L.A. Times, would have noticed if 40 trucks were hauling away this material. Let me deal with your question, though, about Kerry, if I could.
Sure.
All right. And we've heard this before. I mean, you are making the argument, absolutely, that the Bush administration is making time and time again. In terms of, and you and I, frankly, we had this discussion off the record in your radio studio. You say that a president shouldn't ask other countries what they need to join us in the coalition. We shouldn't even ask.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying you can do so, but it should not be a limitless point of criteria. That's my point.
But when did Kerry ever say that?
If you attach a foreverness to it, and you contend that you can't move forward until you finally get the approval, that's a very different thing than suggesting you are just best advised to always seek counsel. There is a disparity that exists between somebody who's never willing to go to the UN or talk with them about things versus somebody who says, you know, we should go, but at one point or another, if we find we've reached an impasse, we shouldn't have ourselves forever be at the mercy of their say-so in order to legitimately have the right to move forward and use military force. That's the problem with Kerry. There's no point of finality to him. He says Bush should have only gone to war as a last resort, but he will not say what that is for him. And I don't know how you can credibly criticize a president for prematurely crossing a line that you will not define for yourself.
But see, Alan, I think you're making a straw man here. John Kerry has made it clear.
No, he's made the straw man by saying you shouldn't go to war unless it's a last resort. The last resort point of criteria is in and of itself a straw man argument if you don't give that last resort benchmark some parameter or finality.
If you
only say you shouldn't go to war until it's a last resort, but you will not define what a last resort is, it is you who has used a straw argument, no one else.
No,
because there's limitless extensions that you can attach to that. It is a contention or an alternative without boundaries. You can't tell me that the president should have only gone to war as a last resort and not tell me what that is for you, because that puts you in the enviable position of being able to criticize without accountability for your own position.
John Kerry has announced that he voted for the authorization to go to war, which of course gives the president negotiating room, something frankly I supported as well, in order to allow the inspectors to have a chance to do their job. He also has said that he would have worked and tried to get foreign powers to come on board, but he's made it very, very clear that that is not a veto, that he does believe in war as a last resort, and that, as Bill Clinton has put it, John Kerry says you try to get other nations on board, but you go it alone if you have to, compared to George Bush, who tries to go it alone, but gets other nations if he has to, and that's a fundamental difference.
He tried the UN first, though we didn't have to in 1991 at Safwan Air Base. But even if we take Kerry at his word, the reality is, apparently, even when all things line up as per his description, and the world is on board, and the UN is on board, he decided to vote against it in 1990 when the entire UN said to Bush the Elder, you have the right to do this. Even then, Kerry voted against it.
But see,
so it seems that even when it comes to the standards that he establishes himself, he refuses to go along.
And I think you're changing the subject again, because I'm trying to deal with this war. I would say, as far as the Persian Gulf War, I've always been a believer that, according to the Constitution, that Congress should declare war. None of this, oh, authorized to go to war if the president has a chance. No. There should actually be a formal declaration of war, the way we did it in World War II. That's what the Constitution says. That's my view. But I want to get to the views of some
of
my colleagues.
But as you also know, has been a bipartisan deviation, and both
you're right.
parties have done it.
And both
Clinton
parties are wrong.
Clinton did it with Kosovo and Bosnia, and I was a big fan of him when he did it.
Yep.
I just don't see Kerry now being accountable for his own inconsistency. The reality is, he said the benchmark points of criteria before going to war should be when the UN's on board. He says it's better if they're on board. And I'm reminding you that when the UN was on board, he still didn't support war.
But again, Kerry said it's better if the UN is on board, but they don't have to be. He supported the war in Bosnia.
So they don't have to be on
board. Which I remind you,
say we should not go to war. That's another way of looking at it.
No, but let me remind you that the Republicans, most of them, John McCain, a good exception, but most Republicans lie. A war to prevent genocide, much like the war in Sudan, which Kerry supports us sending troops in, and Bush doesn't, because Kerry thinks that genocide is a reason to go to war, and apparently Bush only thinks oil is. But let me get to a number of our callers.
I recall genocide being quite preponderant in its posture in Iraq, I think.
In the late 80s, back when we were supporting Iraq.
What's the statute of limitations on that? And when we were supporting,
well, should we go into Germany now?
The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Alan.
Just as we did with the Soviet Union in World War II, and I think most people would regard that as having been a good move.
I don't think it's a good move, and I don't think we should invade Germany now, even though 60 years ago they were a pretty awful country. Let me get to some of my guests, listeners, who've been waiting patiently on the phone. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Alan Nathan.
Yeah, this is 464 from Michigan.
Hello, 464 from Michigan. What's your comment or question for?
Well, I have a theory.
Okay, or theory. What's your theory?
Yes, I think that a chain-smoking chimp that can talk like John Wayne would be just as an effective defense president as George Bush.
Okay. Alan Nathan?
I think a chain-smoking chimp could deploy a battalion of guards to surround Al-Qaqa post-invasion. And or a chimp could smart bomb the facility pre-invasion, knowing that explosives might be compromised in an invasion. I wonder if Alan could comment.
Well, Alan, let me ask you this. Whatever your problems with John Kerry, you've got to agree with our caller that George Bush has done an awful job of protecting us in Iraq.
You know, it's a strange thing. I can acknowledge that we've had a lot of challenges and insurgencies have had some successes, but I still see a difference between, encountered opposition, believed as a victory for the enemy versus our still having dominance despite those challenges. I guess in short I'm saying encountered opposition, plenty of missteps, doesn't mean that those missteps are emblematic of victory or failure.
But
and
isn't
it just seems myopic to suggest otherwise. We have the greater control of the country. And even though we've had challenges, when you reference, like ball scores, the deaths that have occurred in Iraq, without associating them with the accomplishments achieved as a direct result of those same sacrifices, you have ignored contextual proportionality. You have ignored
Alan,
the gains that have been achieved for the sacrifices endured.
But, Alan, you're avoiding the caller's question.
And I think your caller's correct. There have been a myriad of missteps. But I don't know that these missteps can equate with failure or somehow there being this ridiculous fallout of any
situation
whatsoever.
Well, go ahead, caller.
You can equate the situation to Vietnam, where we won most every firefight but lost the political battle because the politics were faulty.
I agree with you there. I'm a Vietnam War protester. Look, this is not a right winger you're talking to. I can outlift the best of them. I was against the Vietnam War, still proud to have been. So what's going on in Iraq, with all due respect, is the epitomizing of apple-orange comparison. With Iraq, you got to remember, in 1991, we had a ceasefire agreement contingent upon Saddam Hussein's compliance with the terms of surrender as set forth at Safwan Air Base in Iraq, March of 1991. He violates the terms of surrender, canceling the contingency, and activates the ceasefire set-aside, all of which the UN was a party to.
And in 1998, when Clinton bombed him for that, the Republicans condemned him, said he was trying to take the attention off Monica Lewinsky, and that's what really mattered for the country.
He didn't bomb enough. He didn't do enough. It
well,
was a superficial gesture.
Did Bush bomb enough?
A real measure of holding Saddam in compliance.
Yeah, but, Alan,
you have a case here where a country was guilty of violating the terms of surrender and was not held accountable for it. Never before in our planet's history have we ever seen one country violate terms of surrender and told the other country that they're not entitled to resume military action.
Alan, though, you're not addressing the caller's question. Couldn't a chimp, as he put it, have understood that when you know where you have these huge weapons dumps, we know exactly where they are, the UN is watching them. Frankly, if we'd allow the inspectors to finish their job, as many argued to do, then Saddam Hussein would have had to destroy them, just like everything else. In any case, we could have smart-bombed them. Don't you agree, at least admit this, in hindsight, it was a colossal mistake for George Bush not to take out those weapons dumps when he knew where they were?
If, in fact, they knew where they were and they didn't have them properly safeguarded and they didn't take preemptive action, I'll agree, but the jury's still out on that. I've heard the administration's response to it, and now I've got to have these two sides of the issue vetted before passing sentence. The reality is, if, in fact, it is as the administration has suggested, that they weren't there upon arrival, that changes the topography of the whole argument.
Actually, it doesn't, because we knew where they were in January. We could have bombed them, but I want to get to another caller. Thank you very much for your call. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Alan Nathan.
This is Ed from New York.
Yes.
And I'd like to ask Mr. Nathan something.
Okay.
It seems to me that he keeps saying he believes George Bush, but he doesn't believe John Kerry. But the problem is George Bush has been proved to have lied to the American people time and time again, whereas Mr. Kerry, on the other hand, doesn't seem to. He admits his own mistakes, and he can think of mistakes that he has made. What's Mr. Nathan's comment?
Good point.
My comment is that they have both been, quite liberal in their use of incredible contentions. I believe both camps have been guilty of hyperbolic rhetoric and distortions. The difference between the two is that with Kerry, throughout his campaign, and more recently in the first two presidential debates, or I should say the first three, Kerry has continued to argue that Bush should have gone to war in Iraq only as a last resort, but will not say what that is for him. We know what it is for Bush. He went to war. We don't know what that is for Kerry, and he will not address it. And all other mistakes notwithstanding, you cannot be taken seriously as a guy who, on one hand, insists that you'll not ever give veto power to another institution or foreign government, and then in the same breath say that we should have gone to the UN before going to Iraq and asked these questions. What do you want? What do you want now? How much more will it take to get you to join us? Because if that isn't pandering for an approval to move forward, coinciding with what forking over the veto power is all about, then I don't know what is.
Are you insisting that George Bush Sr. pandered for approval when he got allies to go ahead and join with us when we invaded Kuwait?
He didn't have to be seen as that because he got it first out of the gate. That's the difference.
Why didn't George Bush Jr. get it out of the gate?
Because there were, shock of all shocks, as it turns out, a deliberate campaign of Saddam Hussein to corrupt the UN Security Council, as was disclosed by the Dofer report, same report that has Democrats turning to Mecca and bowing as it relates to no WMDs having been discovered. The same report that affirmed that there were no weapons of mass destruction is the very same report that said Saddam Hussein had a campaign to corrupt, and he did so. He corrupted officials in China, France, and Russia, three of the five permanent rendering suspects related to going to war.
Are you suggesting that George Bush Sr. was competent and George Bush Jr. was incompetent because George Bush Sr. could get the support of China and Russia and France, while George Bush Jr. was incompetent because he could not get the support of China?
And yet Saddam corrupted Security Council, as was the case with Bush 43. Don't forget, at that time, nobody had yet been the recipient of dollars from the Oil for Food program. They were not yet poisoned. However, when Bush 43 went to that same not-so-august institution, they had spoiled.
Thank you for your call, Ed. Look, my view is that we were always corrupted. America was corrupted. We supported Saddam Hussein in the 80s, in the 90s, to help our oil companies. Remember that during that genocide that apparently Republicans remember now but didn't remember 15 years ago, Don Rumsfeld went just as corrupt as France and Russia. The point is, it doesn't hurt to ask. It's one of those things, the difference between men and women and directions.
It doesn't hurt to ask, but it most assuredly hurts if you must ask with limitless endeavors, if you must ask with no point of finality, another chance, ensuring that there's no leverage ever exacted upon the original offender.
Well, let's talk about last chance. France said that if we would just wait 30 more days... to give the inspectors just 30 more days, they would support us in Iraq. I think the president was a fool not to take that, but I want to go and...
They said the same thing before the first go-around. They made a pledge that they would.
So give them 30 days.
And they broke that promise.
Why don't we test them?
At one point or another, if there's no point of finality, you cannot be taken seriously.
Now, France said they give us 30 days. Saddam Hussein even said he would make his country a democracy. I'm not saying I believe either, but sometimes you have to... Wait, hold on, let me finish. Sometimes you have to call their bluff, and then you can find out whether they agree or disagree.
Interior Minister of France. We're also talking about the Foreign Minister of Russia. These aren't rogue companies that are just in corporate America or corporate or the corporate arena of any of these individual companies. We're not talking about rogue company CEOs. We're talking about public officials at the highest levels of government. The Interior Minister of France and the Foreign Minister of Russia, hell, the President of Indonesia, some high-ranking officials in China. These people were the honoring the very words they put to paper at UN Resolution 1441.
And as we discussed on Friday, Chevron and Halliburton had a vested interest in this war.
By Chevron and Halliburton.
Well, Halliburton controls the vice president, who controls the president. So, in other words, Halliburton does hold elective office, but I need to get to our caller.
Yeah, this is about the third or the fourth time Mr. Nathan has brought up, he's used language kind of suggesting that he doesn't care for Mr. Kerry's statement of that global test. And in fact, he says specifically that you can't be respected as a guy and not be able to, you know, go it alone or whatever he was saying. So I got a little quote for your guest here. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them together, ... a decent respect for the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. It kind of sounds to me like, you know, Thomas Jefferson was kind of one of those guys that Mr. Nathan wouldn't really respect.
Bert's been reading from the Declaration of Independence, and of course he points out that Thomas Jefferson, when writing that, points out that when a nation acts, it should be seen as acting reasonably. That's Kerry's global test. Do you have a problem with that, Alan Nathan?
None whatsoever, but there's a difference between specific arguments and those of generality. Right now, in a Socratic dialogue, point, counterpoint, 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 the reality is you cannot definitively and specifically be critical of the president for having some point of finality or having prematurely crossed the line when you will not define what that is for yourself, all under the camouflage of wishing to seek counsel with other countries. There's nothing wrong with seeking counsel with other countries. However, that should not translate or legitimize the obligation to hold yourself at the mercy of other countries, regardless of how long they wish to string you along. There's got to be a point at which you say, you know what, I've sought your counsel, you have decided not to come on board, we have reached an impasse, let's agree to disagree, and we have to move on in the direction that best serves our nation, the United States, versus UN consensus. And when you take into consideration that the UN Security Council is, for all intents and purposes, corrupted or had been corrupted by the dollars from Saddam Hussein, then it's tantamount to saying to the United States, that we were expected to seriously pass muster before a jury that was getting paid off by the other side.
You've mentioned that. It should be clear that American companies were also paid under the Oil for Food program.
American companies do not equal government
officials. Neither do the French companies.
Enron is not the interior minister of France.
No, it's the interior minister of the United States. Go ahead, Bert.
Your guest is wanting me to draw a line at which, just like Bush, there's either a yes or a no. And the problem is that the world is not as simple as Bush or your guest seem to think. Let me give you an example. Should we operate on all patients with cancer with removable cancer? In general, yes. But what happens if your patient's 99 years old and hooked up to a respirator and you get her off the ventilator? You know, you do the operation and she has 6 months to live in misery and then she dies. You have to make a decision. It's a gray area that's not as simple as your guest or President Bush seems to think. The world is nuanced. There's no specific line at which you cross, you have to invade, under which you can invade. That's not...
Well, hold on. With all due respect, that is a recipe. Wait. With all due respect...
Let me just finish, Alan.
Make a judgment, and President Bush has failed, and your guest refuses to acknowledge this.
With all due respect, nuance is not a license for ambiguity.
Yes,
all right, nuance is shades of gray. You're talking about a recipe for paralysis. What you're suggesting is that if there's never to be a definitive answer expected, then we should just accept the fact that we never have people held accountable for the positions they take.
Well, wait, hold on. Let's have one at a time. Bert, make your point, and then I'm going to thank you very much for your call. Go ahead. Make your point, Bert.
He's making a straw man argument that to recognize nuance is to have paralysis in your decision making. That's not the point. You weigh the evidence, you put it all together, and you make a decision, and I think the evidence demonstrates that President Bush has failed to make good decisions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your call. Alan, it seems to me, and I'm going to give you a chance to respond.
He's referencing a decision that should be made, but with no time frame or expectation of reaching fruition.
Yeah, but do you hear what you're doing?
A decision that's never realized is a decision that's never rendered.
But did you hear what
now,
you're doing?
If people believe in that, go for Kerry.
Okay,
others
no, wait, wait.
Want to hold folks accountable for the positions they claim they take, they should maybe look at Bush.
This is an incredible straw man, since George Bush has never held anyone accountable in his entire administration. You can screw up 9/11, you can lose 760,000 pounds of explosives, you can refuse to cooperate with the 9/11 Commission, you can even disclose a CIA agent for treason, and George Bush will not hold you accountable. It seems to me, Alan, that what you're doing is you're putting two very different standards on Bush and Kerry. When Bush makes a mistake, you're saying, oh, there were missteps in Iraq. You know, he just didn't happen to notice the 380 tons of explosives. He just happened to misstate intelligence on weapons of mass destruction. He just happened to didn't have enough troops in time. He just happened to defend the oil where he didn't defend the weapons dumps. George Bush made mistakes. And then with Kerry, let me make my point. Hold on. Alan.
I'm willing to cite
let me make my point and then you can respond. All right, let me just make my point. Hold on.
He was on record as agreeing with Kerry on the no-go zone.
Let me make my
point. To allow Fallujah and Ramada and Tafala and Samara to continue as no-go zones, and I thought Kerry raised the legitimate point. I have beaten up on Bush on a myriad occasions.
Well, let me just make my point, Alan.
I got to go with somebody who, after saying something, actually has some intention to follow through with it. Look,
Alan, hold on.
And if you're going to use these words, what you say must have something to do with what they mean. Part of my show's mantra is all about the appreciation of shades of gray and nuance. But shades of gray and nuance will never be licenses for never-ending ambiguity. It is not an escape hatch for accountability. It is rather an appreciation of degreed thought. But you can still have points of finality within your context of nuance without somebody thinking that you're just trying to run away from accountability by having one camouflage the other, by having nuance be used as a camouflage for never-ending ambiguity.
Alan, you are not the same.
Your caller knows it. Most reasonable thinking people listening know the same
thing. We have to go to commercial. One of the problems with inviting radio hosts on a radio host show is they often are subjected to filibuster, and we've heard some of that. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Alan. If you want to come back after the break, you're welcome to do so, but I got to take a commercial break, all right? We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
In the year 2000, the Democrats won. take the rejection. They counted the votes in a web of deception. The GOP stole the election.
I bring you tidings of great joy. At last, our Congress critters have done something tangible to lift people up from the economic doldrums. They've raised wages in America. You're not silly enough to think for a moment that Congress would raise your wages, are you? No, no, Nanette. For the past several years, they've kept the minimum wage in our country stuck at the paltry poverty level of $5.15 an hour. It's their wages that they've just raised. Again. By again, I refer to the fact that this is the sixth pay hike that our lawmakers have bestowed upon themselves in the past 6 years. This time, the members will pocket an extra $4,000 each, raising their gross pay to about $162,000 a year. Of course, congressional leaders don't do such dirty work directly. Instead, these steady increases, now totaling some $25,000 over the 6 years, have come surreptitiously. Each year, an automatic congressional increase is tucked deep inside the mammoth appropriation bill for the Treasury Department, a bill that always passes. So members always get a raise, unless they choose to deny themselves by specifically voting to remove the automatic hike. Thus far, they've shown remarkable restraint in this regard. One bold member who keeps trying to say no to this help-yourself dip into the taxpayer's gravy is Jim Matheson, Democrat of Utah. Again this year, Matheson called for a vote on the $4,000 increase. But by a tally of 235 to 170, his colleagues rejected his procedural motion, thus avoiding even having to cast a direct public vote on their money grab. This is Jim Hightower saying, at a time when the wages of average Americans have fallen in terms of buying power, it's good to know whose side your Congress critter is on. To learn how your member of Congress voted on Matheson's attempt at honesty, call Taxpayers for Common Sense, 1-800-TAXPAYER.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
But who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's. Know who's really gelling? The King of Queens, Monday through Friday. Check your local listings.
Your oldest has just turned driving age. Time to add them to your policy. So you get in your car, drive down to your insurance company. Hunt for a space, double park, get a parking ticket, get in a fight with the meter maid, get thrown in jail, meet a guy named Wally. Wait a minute. This is just a bad dream. You've got Geico. You don't have to drive anywhere. You can do all that car insurance stuff online. Oh, that was a close one.
GEICO's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? GEICO. Online at geico.com.
Went on because their intelligence was wrong. Was the reason for war based on lies and corruption? Where are the weapons of mass destruction?
Kick out the Republicans. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, former congressional attorney, bringing you all the news from Washington, D.C. that the government does not want you to know. That special music, of course, means today is Election Tuesday, where we debate those with whom I disagree. And, well, I've been doing that. The debater of choice today is Alan Nathan. He's a nationally syndicated radio talk show host. You can hear him on Battleline on all the Radio American syndicates across the globe. And, of course, like any good talk show host, he's got a flair for talking. I've been trying to get a word in edgewise. But I think he's making his point that even as a militant moderate, he supports George W. Bush. If you want to call in and challenge him, you're always welcome to do that. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can put a comment on the blog. Just go to radioinsidescoop.com and comment there. Alan has had some trouble, I know, when guests call in, so we'll try to make sure that you're not talking over each other in the future. But my point that I see, and I want Alan to address, is that I think he holds Bush and Kerry to different standards. It seems to me that with George Bush, he says, oh, you made a misstep, and therefore I'm not really going to judge you. People make mistakes. And then you look and hear how he talks about John Kerry. With John Kerry, he says, well, we can't really be sure what John Kerry would do. That's, of course, true. John Kerry is not president of the United States right now. So he says John Kerry has failed to specify everything he would do in every conceivable situation. I think that's being unfair to John Kerry, because I think as president of the United States, you have to be there, you have to have all the intelligence. Remember, Bush had intelligence that John Kerry didn't have, and you have to make decisions right there on the spot. So you hear when George Bush is actually making decisions, Alan Nathan lets Bush get away with it. It's just a misstep. But when John Kerry is saying, you know, I would only go to war as a last resort, Alan Nathan is saying, what exactly is that last resort? And the problem, of course, is that it depends on the situation. John Kerry said he would send inspectors in. All right, so that was part of his thing. What would have happened if the inspectors came in and found no weapons? Well, we don't know. It didn't happen. It's a hypothetical. I suspect what would happen if we found no weapons is John Kerry would probably not support us going to war. He would probably put enough pressure on Saddam Hussein that we could destroy what conventional weapons he had, like these 380 tons of explosives. We wouldn't have had to go to war, and we could concentrate on Osama bin Laden and the other places around the globe. But I'm going to give Alan a chance to respond and give you a chance, too. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Go ahead, Alan.
Thanks, Mark. Listen, out of respect for your callers, very quickly, sometimes they just cannot be heard by me, and I think that they have finished when, in fact, they did not. I have a very faint connection over here, so there are times where perhaps they were still talking, but from my perspective, they had stopped talking, and therefore I thought it was my prompt to go ahead. So my apologies to your callers when they phone in. I just can't always hear when they cease talking.
No problem. Let me read to you.
Apropos of what you were talking about, I can outlive the best of them, okay? I agree with the Democrats on HMO reform, gay rights, patients' bill of rights, media consolidation, flag amendment, prayer in school. I can run down the list where I am with you guys. It's only because of this man's decisions to then change decisions with such flair and alacrity that I find myself nervous about having this man responsible for the stewardship of our country. This is it. This is where he loses me.
Well, see, Alan,
When you tell me that I'm wrong in holding him accountable for not having a last resort, that just makes no sense. I say that I remind people that Kerry has said Bush should have only gone to war as a last resort, but will not say what that is for him. You say it depends on the circumstances. That response would be fine if we were talking about a future conflict, but we're not. We're talking about a conflict that had already passed. All right, we already went to war in Iraq. He had the same intelligence as Bush. He made his
decision. No, he didn't have the
wait.
He didn't have the same intelligence
as
Bush.
As Bush. But
Alan.
To be flawed, Bush lied. He was just misled.
Alan, he did not have the same intelligence as Bush. Let's be very clear about this, because I've heard Republicans say this again and again and again. It's just not true. The CIA was counseled not to tell the Senate Intelligence Committee about a number of things. We know now, for example, the State Department said there probably weren't weapons of mass destruction. The Defense Intelligence Agency had doubts about weapons of mass destruction. There was a National Intelligence report that came out in 2001 that said didn't even mention Iraq as a problem. The one that came out in 2002, what they had were a lot of footnotes that said that this stuff probably isn't true, that this was really crazy data. We know that, for example, Dick Cheney went in, manipulated the data, and then they didn't turn over those footnotes to Congress. So
Mark,
please,
Mark,
let's...
there's always going to be competing points of reference in intelligence.
Yeah, but they didn't have the same intelligence.
Let's be fair. Intelligence is nothing more than a collection of disparate pieces of information, usually derived from a myriad of the sources. Analysis of this collection involves assessing what's most plausible and then acting on it in a way that errs on the side of caution.
True.
And that side of caution, that would be the action that best protects our country.
Okay, and Alan?
Now, you're going to have interest in the intelligence community.
Alan, the basic difference, it's very simple, it's as you put it. Bush had access to the raw data. Kerry and the members of Congress did not have access to the raw data. They only had access to the packaging that Dick Cheney and Douglas Feith and the others packaged it in, which was taking the things that Ahmed Chalabi told them and presenting them to the Congress as if it were fact. So,
you're forgetting that in early August, Senator Kerry said that had he known before what he knows now about the missing weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, he still would have voted for the Iraqi war resolution.
That's not
now
what he said.
Now he claims that had he been president, he would not have gone after Saddam. I mean, come on.
No, that's not what he said. That's more Republican.
If his convictions were relationships, they'd all be one-night stands.
But see, what bugs me, Alan, is that it seems to me you're always just believing all the Republican spin. I've seen that quote, and guess what? It's never in quotes. In fact, I hope if you go after this show, you can present on the blog any point where John Kerry actually said that in quotes. That's been attributed to him, and it's not posed in the way you posed it, all right? And no one knows exactly what he said. It was back when he was in Nevada, I believe. So this becomes lore. It becomes lore.
No, Mark, you're wrong. There's video on this. The words are there, and there's nothing taken out of context.
Okay, I want you to post that on my website after the show. Will you do that?
I'll do better than that. I'll send you the audio clip that we played on my show.
Terrific.
And hear his words as well.
Terrific.
I mean,
because
it was only based on the audio clip that I played on my show that we bothered to address it.
Well, no. Terrific. Because my understanding is he was not asked if you know then what it was asked about authorization. And Kerry said yes, he would have supported authorization. Because what authorization did is gave the president the authority to challenge Saddam Hussein. And therefore, authorization made sense. He didn't say he would go to war knowing then what he knows now.
You're trying to argue a contrast where there is no difference. At one point or another, people have to be accountable for what they did. If you read the Iraqi war resolution, it says that if Bush believes that it's untenable to try to continue with the UN and that we find that folks are not going to comply with those resolutions, then it is up to him and he can use his discretion to go to war. So whether or not he voted to time the war as Bush did or B, decided to just vote for the Iraqi war resolution, understanding that that would give Bush the right to use his discretion, they're one of the same. I just don't buy it. You got a guy who voted for a war that would not also vote for the funding of that war. Even people like Tom Daschle, who voted against the war, decided to fund the war. So if Daschle could understand that, why couldn't Kerry?
Number one, John Kerry didn't write that resolution. He had a choice. He could either vote for a resolution that gave the president the authority to determine whether to go to war, or he could vote against it. What you're basically arguing, Alan, is that John Kerry should never have trusted George Bush. Bush said he would use inspections. He said he would go to the United Nations. What you're saying is John Kerry should have known better. He should have known George Bush was lying. He should have voted against the war.
Sorry,
I don't
John
think
Kerry
that's true.
Alan, his decision eventually didn't work out to his political advantage.
Alan, I supported the authorization because I didn't realize that George Bush would screw it up as badly as he did. That is Kerry's mistake. He should have realized that Bush was incredibly incompetent. He actually thought as president he would be a leader. When you authorize someone else to do something for you, okay, why is it a mistake? It's not a mistake in general. I think most of us, including myself, would agree if we had a president we could trust, absolutely. The reason you authorize him to go to war is not because you want war. It's because you understand that when you authorize the president to go to war, that puts pressure on Saddam Hussein that makes him comply.
Allow me, if you will, to respond with this.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you
okay.
Fine.
I love these arguments of mythical comparisons. If your opponent does something well, you juxtapose it to an artificially elevated standard which should have been reached but wasn't. Accordingly, the former, once a good thing, becomes a failure by default. This is classic sophistry. The Republicans did it against Clinton when it was convenient for their position, and the Democrats are no less guilty of it right now. And I think it's unfortunate. Either you take responsibility for the vote you cast or you do not. Trying to, access an escape hatch after the fact is not commensurate with anybody who's truly of principle.
Alan, I just got to say that to me, it just sounds like spin, 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 spin. We're going to make this thing simple. We're going to pretend that the war is it's a very simple place. You can either vote for authorization to go to war or vote against it. What I don't think you're getting, and we're going to go to commercial, and I want to hear from you when we come back, but what I don't understand is this. Can't you authorize someone to do something and that be the right thing to do, but then that person misuses their trust? You
then
may have every...
After the invasion, Kerry was on record
saying
that he agreed with what Bush did. Why is it also on... He was on record as saying that it would be irresponsible not to vote for the $87 billion to fund the very vote that he cast in support of the war, and then immediately turn around and decide not to vote for the $87 billion.
I'll address...
What he described as that which would be irresponsible, he in fact did, and you know that he stated this. This is all empirically verifiable. It's all been on video, played over and over again. His words, no one else's.
I will get to the $87 billion and to your calls at 877-57-SCOOP right after this break.
Time for another Gooberhead Award. Presented periodically to those in the news whose tongues are moving 100 miles an hour, but who forgot to put their brains in gear. Today's Gooberhead is Representative Candace Miller, a Michigan Republican who has written a bill that effectively will require all Americans to start carrying a national ID card. The idea of having to show your papers has been an anathema to liberty-loving Americans since the founding of our nation. Yet, ironically, so-called conservatives like Miller are now demanding such autocracy. This legislation would authorize the Homeland Security Czar to require all states to standardize everyone's driver's license. The Czar would set federal rules for the data that people would have to provide to get a license, requiring that every state license include such data. The feds could require your fingerprints, eye prints, or any other personal identifying information, thus nationalizing our driver's licenses. Yet Representative Miller, obtuse to the Orwellian nature of her own bill, says blithely, "I don't think this is anything that should cause anyone concern." No, it should not cause concern. It should cause us apoplexy. Not only would she let the Homeland Czar usurp the authority of states, but she also lets the feds require all of the states to funnel our license info into a linked national database that will be available to a broad range of government agencies and corporations. This amounts to a backdoor way of creating a national ID card. If it passes, you won't be able to get on an airplane, rent a car, enter a government building, or otherwise move about freely without showing your federally sanctioned papers. It creates a new system of internal passports for what we once hailed as the land of the free. This is Jim Hightower saying, to fight this goober-headed stumble toward a federal police state, call the ACLU, 212-549-2500.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
Says he cares about the middle class, but the giant corporations get all the cash. We got a $500 billion deficit. It's time to make the Republicans quit.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop this Election Tuesday, just 1 week before the real Election Tuesday, when you can make your choice between Bush and Kerry. And as always, every Tuesday, I invite on the show someone with whom I disagree, and I couldn't disagree more with Alan Nathan, at least on the issues that we're discussing. Now, Alan Nathan, a nationally syndicated talk show host, you can hear his show, Battle Lines, on Radio America and radio stations, dozens of them across the country. He says he agrees with we Democrats on all kinds of domestic issues, but he disagrees on the war on terrorism. And I have trouble understanding really what he's saying. Let me tell you why, and then I'm going to give Alan one last chance to respond here. It seems to me that here I am, we began the show, I'm explaining, decrying the fact that, as the International Atomic Energy Agency has said, terrorists are now helping themselves to the greatest explosives bonanza in history. That's George Bush's fault. Everyone concedes that we knew where they were. The inspectors were there. They were watching it. We ordered them out. And George Bush said it was, not George Bush, but the Bush administration said it was a medium priority site. We had high priority sites. Those were the oil fields. And we didn't protect the explosives. Now, Alan Nathan says that's just a misstep. And then he turns and he goes into what I see as just typical Republican spin, where he goes on and he says, well, John Kerry can't have it both ways. He can't say he authorized the war and that he supports that vote and that, you know, now it was the wrong war at the wrong time. Let me give an analogy, because I think this really explains why I don't see John Kerry as contradicting himself in the least. Let's say that I want to buy something. I want to buy something at the grocery store, maybe out into the bazaar, right? So I send my son, and my son says, let me go, let me buy this, big steak, all right? Let me go buy the big steak for you. And I say, well, I don't know, can I trust you? And he says, yes, I'll do the right thing, I'll negotiate a good price, I'll be great. So I say, all right, I authorize you to go do the right thing, negotiate a good price, bring home the steak. So then my son goes, and what does he do? Well, my son, he's a bit of a recreant. He doesn't negotiate the steak, the price, right? He just goes in, he shoots the butcher, grabs the meat, and runs home with a bunch of angry people chasing after him, all right? And then my friend goes to me and say, Mark, how could you authorize your son, who you never should have trusted, to go? And I have to say, well, look, I thought I could trust him. I thought, you know, I could judge him. Now I know better. I should never have authorized this son, right, this president, in the case of John Kerry, to do the work of America. Maybe I would authorize a normal human being to do it, a normal president. But no, I was wrong because my son, the president, did it in the wrong way. Now, I don't see any inconsistency there. I absolutely support the authority of a normal president to go in, to negotiate, to even use the threat of war to get a good bargain. But I never expected that George Bush would just run off and violate everything, the international law, torture people, and go in and have the entire world mad at us. And I got to tell you, if John Kerry had voted against the war, you know what the Republicans would say. Oh, he didn't even give Bush a chance. He didn't even give Bush a chance to do the right thing. John Kerry, how awful. He didn't even give Bush a chance. Kerry gave Bush a chance. And it's amazing to me that people will say that because George Bush has messed up so badly in Iraq, that's somehow John Kerry's fault. That's really extraordinary. Also, as the $87 billion, that's the favorite Republican talking point. You listeners, we've talked about it. We know the truth. And that is, there were two bills that provided $87 billion to our troops. John Kerry supported one. George Bush supported the other. John Kerry supported paying for the war in Iraq. And George Bush supported not paying for the war in Iraq. John Kerry was against leaving the debt on future generations. George Bush said, I will veto the bill unless we leave the debt on future generations. Neither of them flip-flopped. They just supported different versions of the bill. That's not something you're going to hear on a conservative talk show host show, because they've got it enveloped in all kinds of spin. But, Alan, you got 2 minutes left to make your closing points.
All right, going back to your analogy about your son, I guess he would be equal to Bush and the shopkeeper would be equal to the U.N.?
Shopkeeper would be Kerry.
All right.
Oh, no, excuse me. The shopkeeper would be U.N. The father would be Kerry,
right.
My creative analogy.
Right, right. So your father is Kerry, your son is Bush, and the shopkeeper is the U.N.
Right.
All right. That analogy assumes no wrongdoing by the shopkeeper. But if the shopkeeper is, in this instance, the U.N., we see plenty of wrongdoing, which is part and parcel of the U.N. behavior, namely that they were the chief recipients of bribery dollars from Saddam. And if we can think of the U.N. as a jury, who wants to pass muster with a jury that's getting paid off by the other side? So you're assuming facts not in evidence that should be.
No, but
that
you
is that with the U.N., it was a corrupt jury, whereas with the shopkeeper, I'm sure he's an innocent man. Now, when you reference other things having to do
But was it wrong to give Bush authorization, or was it right to give Bush authorization to go to war?
It was absolutely, perfectly valid and sound.
Okay, I agree with you. I agree with you.
Not with a bottomless well of escape hatches for you to dodge accountability after the fact.
But that's whose fault is that?
Whose fault? It with the caveats as written in the Iraqi War Resolution, and the Iraqi War Resolution set the standards for what would entitle Bush to move ahead. Kerry knew that after Bush tried to go to the UN, if it turned out that they were going to turn their backs on the UN Resolution 1441 and would not comply with their own literature,
that's not what Bush said.
Bush had the right to hold them accountable and move on.
No, that's not what Bush said. Bush said that he was going to send the inspectors back and give them a chance to finish their job. That's what he said when the Senate voted on that war resolution. Bush changed his mind, but that's not the fault of the senators.
No, what happened was, is you're forgetting, UN Resolution 1441 said to Saddam Hussein, comply immediately or face serious consequences. 4 months, 5 months, along outside the outside the time limit set up, is nothing, is having no relevance to the word immediate. There's not the least infinitesimal correlative relevance between a 4, 5, or 6 month waiting period and the word immediate.
Alan,
had Saddam Hussein not conducted himself as if he had something to hide, I assure you, immediate compliance would have disarmed Bush's quest for war, and all of this would be moot.
Well, we've got to end the discussion here. Our hour is up. Alan, I hope you will consider, just think about maybe whether you're being a lot harder on John Kerry than you are on George Bush. I don't know if we can change your vote. Probably not. But, you know, that's what we do here on Election Tuesday. Thank you, Alan, very much for being on the show.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
And I hope you've enjoyed our debate tomorrow.
Have a lot of fun with it, man.
Well, good. Tomorrow we've got a very interesting show as well, because we're going to have a discussion of whether George Bush is a fiscal conservative. There are people out there that claim that the thing that's most important to them is the government not running up a huge